Happy Healthy Tuesday, and welcome to A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this week we are going to zoom into some areas that we haven't talked about on the show before that I think will really kind of tie together some existential angst that many people, myself included, experience and have been experiencing over the last couple decades. And that has to do with eco-anxiety. So I don't know about you, but there are enough things in my life that I worry about or fret about, which is one of my grandmother's favorite terms, you know, that fretting feeling of constantly having something in the back of your mind that you're worried or anxious about. It just kind of floats there, but it never really gets resolved, that fret feeling. I can picture my grandmother's, you know, fingers always kind of rubbing together like there was something that just was unresolved. I think we all carry that with us about certain things that we're not really able to identify, or maybe we just carry worries in general, which I have those, right? That feeling that we're dwelling on a difficulty or trouble that we can't also wrap our head around or can't quite solve or fix in the moment. And then we all tend to experience just that general anxiety, that worry, that unease, that fret, that nervousness about something that might be specific or something that might be uncertain or an uncertain outcome. And so when I think about those common things that we are anxious about or we worry about or we're fretting about, we can think of elections, outcomes, transitions, losses, ends of relationships, disappointments, health fears and concerns, right? Those are the things that kind of bubble around in our day-to-day life as human beings. But there's one other underlying fear, worry, anxiety, and I would actually put it in the fret zone about the future of our planet, the future of our ecosystem, the future of human beings' existence on the planet, and something that we can't quite wrap our heads around, even though we hear the data and understand the changes and see the changes in our climate inconsistencies. It's so large and so giant that it's hard to comprehend how we got here or what we're going to do. And even more so, it's hard to get up every day and see the changes and know that things are not going to be the same and feeling like we're out of control. And so for a lot of clients or a lot of people in general have been experiencing the normal anxieties, worries, fears of the human experience. But then underneath that is such a deep sense of grief and impending loss and sense of helplessness when it comes to the environment, that sense of worry and fret never, ever gets alleviated. Because in other parts of our life, if we're dealing with death, or ends of relationships, or even elections, they tend to have a time-limited experience. You either move through the death loss, you move through to the next election, you get over the end of a relationship. But when it comes to this fundamental anxiety, fear, and fretting about the future of the planet, there is no fixed or time-limited experience. And so we're now living in this existential fear all the time. And so I have invited a guest to come on the air and talk to us about how can we manage, deal with, address the fret and worry and anxiety that's connected to climate change and ecological disasters. So this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and you can be part of the conversation by sending me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com after the show, or join us on Facebook, Instagram. You can leave me a message there as well. You can listen to previous shows by visiting kcbx.org or podcast our show wherever it is you get your podcasts. Just search for A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist and the shows will be there for you to listen to and leave a review to join, to bring other people into the conversation. We're going to be inviting in our guest, Dr. Thomas Doherty, in just a moment. We'll be back after this break to start our conversation right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and Dr. Doherty, thank you so much for joining me on the show today.
Thanks, Elizabeth. I'm really glad to be here.
Let me introduce you a little bit to my audience, and then you can fill in the gaps. Dr. Doherty is a clinical and environmental psychologist living up in Portland, Oregon. So thanks for hanging out with us today. 30 years experience specializing in applying an environmental perspective to mental health and well-being through his practice, The Sustainable or Sustainable Self. Dr. Doherty is a fellow of the American Psychological Association. He was part of the first task force of global climate change, the founding editor of the academic journal Ecopsychology, the past president of the Society for Environmental Population and Conservation Psychology. And your early career, or Dr. Doherty's early career, I guess, inspired this part of your career as a wilderness therapy professional and a professional whitewater guide and an environmental advocate for Greenpeace. Dr. Doherty is also in the process of finishing his latest book, Surviving Climate Anxiety, A Guide to Coping, Healing, and Thriving, which is going to be a resource with practical examples for the general population that will be drawn from his experiences with clients. I think I hit some, there's a lot more here that we'll hit throughout the hour, but Dr. Doherty, you clearly have a lot of experience with climate change and climate anxiety. So I'd love to know what drew you to this work.
Well, yeah, thanks, Elizabeth. I mean, it's a great question, and I really appreciated your, you know, opening remarks about fretting and just carrying the weight of the world, because it's normal. The reality is, if you start talking about something that scares you, then you're actually being brave. Yes, you're actually being courageous, right? So, so by having these conversations, we're actually dealing with the issue automatically. So just something to think about, because put some tools on the table before we even dive into these. So, you know, one is environmental identity, that we have a sense of our identity in relation to nature, and we have values and things we love and childhood experiences and all these things that underlie why we're concerned or why we might be fearful. And we have responsibilities. If you're a parent, you have responsibilities to your children, or if you own a business, or, you know, we think about our own personal health. So we have all these values and responsibilities. And, you know, there's a saying, as you probably know in therapy, you know, we hurt where we care. So that, you know, it's good to sort of open the conversation with care. Because then we're less likely to get sort of just running around in circles with a lot of these questions, because thinking about something as big as the state of the world is naturally complicated. The world's a big place. And so if we just start to assume we can use blanket terms for even a word like or a phrase like climate crisis or global crisis or poly crisis or all these words that get thrown around, they're technically true, but also we have to be careful of not creating language that makes us hamstrings us from the outset, where we create words and images that are inherently unable to cope with, and then we wonder why we feel overwhelmed. So
I really like how you started off talking about that it's courageous to have this conversation, because it's all the things we don't talk about that tend to drive our mental discomforts, right? Yeah. The secrets or the hidden fears or the fretting. I really landed on fretting, because that really is this constant worrying and nitpicking about something that we really can't act on. So I love that you started with the courageousness, because that's where I want to kind of land with this. Whole hour is that practical kind of the book you're writing, those practical ways that we can accept and move forward. But I'm gonna push you back a little, because I'm really curious to know how you found your way to this, because you probably didn't start off to be an eco-psychologist, especially if you were in a professional whitewater guide. So how did you go from there to where you are today? Give me a little journey.
Yeah, I mean, yes, there was no such thing as an eco-psychologist when you and I were younger. That's a new term. Mm-hmm. I mean, even that term eco-psychology I mean, the underlying ideas are not new, obviously. You know, people's connections with nature and the natural world is perennial. You know, humans are part of nature. All cultures have connections with nature, and of course, we can find a rich history in any culture in any place in human history. But the ter literal term eco-psychology is like a modern, it's a modern day term that's sort of saying what if we and eco-psychology didn't come out of psychology. It actually came out of environmentalism, people that were doing environmental work and saying, how can we approach our environmental work from a psychological perspective, like thinking about our identity and our values and sort of this you know, underlying sense that we're split off from nature, you know, in Western culture, that our the way we talk about nature, we put humans separate, and you know, let's go to the heart of that. So that's kind of where that those ideas come from. And those that term eco-psychology was actually it came out, it met me at a time in my life that I was open to it, because that term was popularized in the mid 1990s. That was a time when I was in my 20s, and I was looking for my life direction, and I had not had a you know, I didn't have any sort of special nature background. I grew up in Buffalo, New York, Western New York, and went to college in New York City. But I was inherently interested in, you know, at least what I thought of as nature at the time, and traveling and going out into the woods. And so I saw it as, you know, so before I got into this eco-psychology stuff, I like a lot of people, I just wanted to travel and see the world and do American kind of things, like, oh, if I'm from the East Coast, I need to go out west and go to the Rocky Mountains and go raft on rivers, and you know, just that kind of youthful, those youthful desires led me to do outdoor work, which then opened me up to how powerful you know, outdoor experiences are, and just this idea of connection with nature. And at the time, environmental identity, although I didn't know that term at the time, that's what I was doing. I was developing my environmental identity. And then by chance, and as life happens, started to connect with people that were doing outdoor therapy, where, you know, therapists that were actually taking young people out in nature. And just also realized that what outdoor people have known all along is that it's very healthy, mentally healthy, to be in nature. And what people like river rafting guides know, people come out to nature to restore themselves and to have fun and excitement and to have, you know, deep experiences connecting with nature. So that kind of all that stuff came together kind of organically, you know, working at Greenpeace, learning about environmental issues, being a river guide. Once you start to do outdoor work or get connected to any kind of place, you naturally want to know about it and protect it, or you become aware of threats. You can't really be a river rafter and not learn about environmental issues and threats to rivers and dams and pollution and all these kinds of things. So that was all coalescing, and I had some, technically, you know, I had some mentors that were psychologists that were leading some of these outdoor programs. And I didn't know at the time that they were quite rare, actually. There's not many psychologists do that. I was under the mistaken assumption that was normal in psychology. You know, I had a rude awakening when I actually became a psychologist and saw how rare that was. But it did lead me in. So I had mentors, just like a lot of your listeners. We have mentors and people that show us the way. And that's, of course, a big part of our environmental identity is the mentors that we have. So anyway, and it's interesting because when I did start studying to be first to be a counselor and then to be a psychologist and then in a doctoral program, again, that was in the late 1990s when these environmental ideas were kind of floating around, and there really wasn't any way to formally study it. There weren't any programs in eco-psychology, so I had to kind of cobble it together by one of the things I did in graduate school was spent part of my time in the environmental studies program, kind of moonlighting in those courses. And I think, like a lot of your listeners, young people, your interests don't fit neatly in a topic. Like a lot of people have interests, so I want to do some psychology and I want to do some environmental studies, and it can be very tough for students because, and you know, as an educator, because there's departments and you have to pick a department. So at least at the time that I was trying to study this in the 1990s, there was no place to go because the psychology would people would say, well, this is not what we do, so you need to go to environmental studies. And when you go to environmental studies and say, I want to study nature therapy, they say, oh, we don't do therapy here. You need to go to the counseling program. And so, because these are what are called, they're not even interdisciplinary ideas, they're transdisciplinary. They actually don't fit in any discipline, they're in between. So again, long story short, I had to kind of make my own way, which is, you know, by starting to talk about this, by doing my own course of study. I ended up creating a program at Lewis and Clark Graduate School for, you know, counselors to study nature. So I kind of created the program that didn't exist for me.
You're the founding father of the ecotherapy movement in some ways. If you're just tuning in, my guest today is Dr. Thomas Daugherty. He's a clinical environmental psychologist, 30 years experience specializing in applying an environmental perspective to mental health and well-being. And this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. And so, Dr. Daugherty, I'm hearing a couple of things. So I want to maybe hone in on the definition, because as you talk about people who are in nature really vested, right? Outdoor people. I would imagine that they experience that climate anxiety or sadness or grief probably more viscerally than people that live in the city. I don't know if that's true. And how did this become like a practice? Was it a practice of grief or a practice of practicality or sustainable? Like, what were the pieces that became the practice? What is the focus of the work, if that makes sense.
Yeah, those are all good questions, and it's they're all part of the answer. It is true. So we all have an environmental identity and a sense of ourself in relation to nature. Even if you don't consider yourself an outdoor or nature person, that's itself a form of environmental identity.
And is that a part of the human developmental process, is it an identity, a nature identity, or is that unique to your work? You know what I'm saying? It's like, has that always existed?
Yeah, I think it's always existed, and I think of environmental identity just the way I think about gender identity or sexual identity or cultural identity. It's a form of identity that we have within us that we can develop, and the more we develop the different kinds of identities we have, the more we understand ourselves and know how to be a good person. And so I think environmental identity is important to develop because it helps us to understand why we're concerned, why we care about nature, and it also taps us into our strengths and our values. Just like any other kind of identity, we become empowered then to grow it and act it and develop it. And it's it is a double-edged sword. People that are connected with a specific place and understand a specific ecosystem or have general, you know, either out, you know, there's three basic values that lead to environmental concern, either egocentric values, concern about my own personal health, my family, my children, that's perfectly appropriate. And altruistic values, concerned about other people, people less fortunate, people around the world, you know, that are suffering from climate or environmental issues or any other issue. And then, you know, what they call, you know, biocentric or ecological values, which is concerns about other species and the land itself, right? And so those are three basic values, and we all have some combination of those. And those lead us to have environmental concerns and care. So they kind of underlie eco anxiety in some way. And so it is a double-edged sword. If I have super strong environmental values, then that's a beautiful thing and it's something to celebrate. But of course, it leaves me more sensitive to the threat because I know more. I know more about things. I can't, you know, ignorance is bliss, as they say. So a lot of people don't know, what's going on. And once you have some kind of eco awakening or waking up syndrome, as they call it, around climate, that's when people want to come and see a therapist. That's because that's why we have this interest and rise in ecotherapy, because in the last several years, in particular, climate change has become a present threat for many people all around the world, including the therapists themselves. And so this has now effectively become a basic practice that all therapists need to know a little bit about, Just like all the other things you talk about in your show, therapists need to be generalists in some way and understand a range of issues. And so, eco-angst, climate angst, coping with disasters is unfortunately something that's best practice to know about. And then, of course, some therapists will specialize in it and get really into it. And so that's kind of the world that I'm living in now, where I'm helping to train therapists and helping to craft this. It's not maybe what I'd like to do. Maybe I'd more focus on river rafting and all the positive things, but part of our duty and responsibility right now is to step up to this challenge. We have no choice. So that duty responsibility is another kind of powerful way to think about this. And how does each person do what they can in their own way, in their own unique place? So,
Is there, I know I jumped questions, so I'm going to jump back to it.
sure.
Is it a, I guess from my personal experience, it's a grief response that I feel, that is that underlying sadness that this like doesn't ever get alleviated. And especially when we just went through a long drought in California, and to watch everything, just get dry and the lakes go down, and that just physical pain that goes along with that grief, is that the common response, or are there other responses that are part of that eco anxiety?
Yeah, I think it's a common entry into the issue. Like a lot of things, we notice something when it pains us, and it draws our attention. And yeah, so some of the doorways would be, and again, it's important again to be careful of our language. These are all normal emotions. All these emotions that we're talking about, anxiety, grief, depression, loss, are all normal. They happen, and they're supposed to happen because that's what life holds. And to be a healthy person, you need to have all these feelings. And so, so a lot of people will come into the door because of these difficult feelings. Because by definition, if you're feeling, happy about nature and enjoying connection on a sunny day and river rafting, who needs a therapist, right? I mean, we're doing fine. So we come in when we're not feeling well. But then, the goal is to honor those feelings, but not get stuck in them. So the doorway might be pain or concern or fear or grief. And that's something to address. But then there's a whole wheel of emotions there, which includes the positive as well, the joy, the awe, and also just more middle ground emotions, just like presence, awareness, curiosity. So yes, the doorway is the painful. And then part of the way we cope with the painful is to remind ourselves of all the other positive feelings. So, I mean, some of this just grades into just general therapeutic work. I talk with clients, I have the image of having an emotions party. So if you can imagine all your different emotions, like I have a feelings list of hundreds of emotions. And if you have a party and you only invite anxiety to the party, that's a certain kind of party, right? And anxiety is welcome, but if we also invite curiosity, if we invite anger, which is a protective emotion, curiosity, mindfulness, patience, compassion, then suddenly anxiety has a lot of supports around it, and it can exist for what it is, and have its voice, but it can be supported by your own compassion and also protected by your own anger and your empowerment. So we want to have an emotions party in
I
general
like
with
that.
a any issue in our life, but especially with this environmental stuff. So it's both, and we want to honor grief and loss and not be afraid of it, but we don't want to. We have to know when to get, not when to bring in other emotions.
Do you find that people recognize that part of their challenge or their mental discomfort is related to their anxiety about the changing climate around them or the changing world around them? Or does that come up later, right? Do people walk in with a, I'm feeling really depressed and anxious, kind of that generalized anxiety, and then you find your way to the eco piece? Or do you find that people are already aware of that sense of loss and grief?
I think they're already aware. I mean, it's kind of hard not to if someone's even remotely educated about the world. The messages that we know are true about global, what I would say, climate change isn't even really the right word. It's more like climate breakdown. I mean, to put a finer point on it, it's rapidly accelerating out of control climate breakdown with no clear bottom to it yet. Part of, if this was an addiction metaphor, for we talk about raising the bottom, so the person just doesn't really slide so deep into their addiction that they kill themselves. We want to kind of bring the bottom up so they can get better. And so we're, globally essentially trying to bring the bottom up by having these global climate meetings and the IPCC and getting countries to commit to decarbonization, because the scientists are saying we don't know what's going to happen. We can only predict, and we need to take this action. And that's terribly scary for the general public. And so, on the one hand, there's no way to be as profound as even we want to try to be about this. This is a huge topic. The reason why we have so many political problems all around the world in terms of, political polarization is because leaders globally have not been able to give a story to the public that people feel safe about. And so everyone is massively concerned about the state of the world. And it leads to these really extreme responses in the world. And, not to get way into global politics, but I just want to name that this is real stuff. So of course, it's normal that someone would be concerned about this. It's of course it is, and we have to really honor that and say, yes, for sure. It means we're intelligent and human, and to be able to move forward into that, without having clear answers, takes a lot of guts and courage. It's super challenging.
If you're just tuning in, my guest today is Dr. Thomas Doherty, a clinical and environmental psychologist, joining us today to talk about kind of the grand scale of eco-psychology, eco-therapy, and how that practice is becoming more and more important to the general population as we move forward. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. We're going to take a quick break and come back and continue our conversation right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Living in a tree, yeah, that's where I'd like to be. Can say nothing, which I guess means they'll say something, but I won't be around. I'll be in my tree, living free as any child wanna be.
This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. My guest today is Dr. Thomas Doherty, a clinical environmental psychologist from Portland, Oregon, joining us today to talk about the experiences that we're all having around the rapidly changing climate, our eco-anxiety, eco-fears. And with 30 years' experience, Dr. Doherty was actually the first task member of the first task force of global climate change, looking at what we're experiencing nationally and globally. He is a fellow of the American Psychological Association, past president of the Society for Environmental, Population, and Conservation Psychology. He has his own podcast that he co-hosts, Climate Change and Happiness: How to Cope with Climate Stress. And Dr. Doherty is also working on his upcoming book, Surviving Climate Anxiety: A Guide to Coping, Healing, and Thriving. Which will be a resource actually for the general public, which will be drawn from his client stories. And so, Doctor, I'd like to, can you help create the kind of the image of what practice, because I'm using terms like eco-psychology and ecotherapy, and what, how do you describe what it is you do, and what are the words around that?
Yeah. Well, eco-psychology is a broad term that just helps to, in a one way, I think about the term eco-psychology is if we create a box called ecology and we think about nature and then we put a small box called psychology inside of that, we could think about, what would psychology look like if we really thought about our, connections with the planet and all that sort of stuff. So that it's a general philosophical take, but practically, ecotherapy or climate therapy could be as simple as any therapist or counselor helping a person to work through concerns about climate disasters or literal disasters or events that happened in their region or their fears about things that could happen in the future or fears for their children or fears for their grandchildren or many, many other related topics of someone struggling to decide if they want to have children or not, for example, or a grandparent grieving the loss that their children might not have children and they might not be a grandparent. There's all kinds of edges to these issues that come up. Sometimes they're not specifically, and they might not be thought about as environmental. If you have a disaster, it's a disaster, a storm or fire. Some people might link it to a larger global climate situation. Other people are just dealing with the disaster. But so eco or climate therapy could just be as simple as using therapy to help with some of these concerns. Or you could, like with any issue in therapy, like couples counseling or ADHD or addiction, you could specialize in it. You could really get involved in it and really look at all the different facets of it. And so not everyone needs to specialize in anything, but people do tend to get drawn to specialties for various reasons. So I guess I have a specialty around this area, which again, as we talked about earlier, comes from all kinds of background things. I mean, I joke that the world has caught up to me because I've been interested in this for a while, and as you know, many many people have been interested in the climate or the environment for many many years for many reasons. I do an exercise where I have people line up. If I'm working with a group, I'll have them line up and say, "When did you first become aware of the serious issue of climate change in your life?" And it's really fascinating because if you have a mixed group, some people, if they're older, say like they're 60 or 70, they can point to a time. The first Earth Day in 1970, or a college class they took, or they saw Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth movie, or they read Silent Spring. So that was an awakening of environmental identity. But as you get younger, as you work with, undergraduates, as you get younger, people start to point to, well, I learned about this in high school or elementary school. But when you get young enough, they've always known. Young people have always known. They were born into a world of climate change. And for someone like myself who's in their 50s, it's, well, wow, that's interesting because when I was a kid, climate change was not a reality. So anyway, I love talking about this because it's just fascinating. But, really, we have all these different ways to tap in. And so from the therapy side, there's a developmental side. Young people have certain needs, elders, things like that. So ecotherapy is trying to make space for all of these different questions.
That are all kind of linked to the day-to-day anxieties or life decisions that we're making. Because you brought up something, it was almost like we were in sync in our brains for the moment, because this conversation about, or this idea about not having children for fear of the future of the planet and the grieving of grandparents, should young people not be bringing children into the world as it is right now?
Yeah. Well, obviously that's a question for each person to answer in their own private heart, but I think our duty is to make a space where people can talk about that so they don't feel alone and isolated in that, just like any other challenge. And you could specialize, and I work with therapists, and we'll talk about a topic, and I'll say, like, you can have a full practice if you specialize in this. And you could literally specialize in just child questions for parents, because, and when you just scratch the surface on this, you start to realize that every generation has had some variation on this theme. People have questioned having children during world wars or during the nuclear threat of nuclear bombing or different other ecological threats, or certainly some cultures, and people and groups have been marginalized and oppressed. And so having children, much like other kinds of environmental identity, it means a lot of unique and different things to people. And it is what's profound, I think, about this current topic is it's a taboo often to talk about having children or not, because there's certain assumptions in culture, and climate change is pushing on some of these taboos that we should always grow, there should always be more people, we should always want to have children. And I'll just tell you, I've heard many different answers. Some people do decide that having children is not how they want to devote their life. Other people, feel like having children is a statement of belief and value in the future and in their culture. And so everyone has a different story, and I've learned to be very humble about it, particularly when I talk to African American person or a Native American person or people from other countries, social classes. There's just a lot of stories there. The danger is to politicize it, where you start to use child questions as some sort of, lever or something to beat up on people, because that's very toxic.
I just it makes me sad that the idea of climate change or climate destruction, or I can't remember the term that you used, or rapidly changing
Yeah,
climate
breakdown. Yeah.
breakdown, thank you, is pointed to as like the reason for I can't bring children to the world because of this, because I also feel as you do that it's always risky having children. In every generation, it's risky and it takes a lot of courage to do that. And I'm not sure what this, because I teach family psychology, so I'm always in that space, and
Sure.
it's interesting that the generation millennials and Zs below us are talking about not having children. They'll say it's because of the environment, but it has a lot to do with the job of raising children is not pleasant for them. And so part of me feels a little bit like, are we using climate, right? Are we using this climate fear as kind of an excuse to not address the more of the social issues? Which probably isn't where we're going today, but that's kind of where I feel like in some ways the climate changes or breakdown is making social choices, or you know what I'm saying, like leading
Yeah.
social choices when it's not really a thing. So I'd love to talk about, from your experience 30 years doing this work, what is the reality of quality of life or climate breakdown for human beings? Like, what do you see as the trajectory?
Yeah, I mean, another why reason this is important to talk about, because it opens these big existential questions about what does life mean? People say, like, will we survive, etc. And that's where we have to be careful about the language, because the issue isn't we. Like, I personally, the world is a complex place, and there's many, many kinds of people, and many people are going to be quite safe with climate change. Even if there's disasters, they're going to have the resources to build. Even if they had to walk around with life support systems, they could do that, and they could afford that, and things like that. So it's not a question about whether we will survive. It's a question of who will survive and how we will survive. And so that's really where the work is. People in sort of first world, more privileged countries need to take responsibility for their contribution to climate change, and this is being argued actively even today in international courts. We have to take responsibility in the US for what we've done, so we can, help people in other countries. So, because the paradox with this all this work, and it comes back to the positive side of it, is, and if I can say this simply, when I working with people or working with therapists, it's when you get into these issues, it's worse than you think. Like with most problems, if you're an auto mechanic and the person brings in their car, they think it's a small thing, and the auto mechanic says, "No, actually, it's a big problem, and it's going to be really expensive to fix." Right? That's how it is with most environmental things. They're bigger and worse than we think once we get into them, and that can be really devastating. But once you start taking action, you realize things are better than you realize also, because we don't 97% of news we get about climate change is problems. Only 3% is about solutions. So there's a massive disconnect in what people hear. So when you actually take action, you work with people that are making innovations in solar panels and government and social justice and helping with disaster. You know, the disasters are getting worse, but disaster fatalities are going down because we're getting better at dealing with them. So that's a great example of how things are getting worse and better at the same time. And so that's a takeaway for your listeners, is that it's both better, it's both worse than you think, just like most things. That's common sense. Once you get into a problem and you're naive, you realize, oh gosh, this is worse than I thought, once I educate myself about it. And that's the case with many things. But you know, once I start to learn what's happening, I realize, oh, I never knew all these positive things that were happening, and I never knew we had all these options. And the funny thing about technologies is it's exponential change. So bad things happen at a worse and faster rate, but good things happen also at a faster rate. So like the transition to non-fossil fuel energy is also exponentially growing, right? So there's it's a it's once you get into this, it's a mixed bag of both positive and negative. But once you're there, then you're really in reality. And that's the place to start. And I think that's similar with most things, therapeutic issues, right? Once you get into a place where you're like, oh, I understand this, then I have leverage and I can see there's positive things are happening and negative, then we're way better than just global ideas of like, we're all doomed or everything is great, buy a new product. You know, there's a middle ground there
Right.
that we're hoping for.
Right. It's funny. It seems like we tend to go to these big extremes, even in our political conversations about climate change. So, would you consider yourself a climate optimist or an eco-optimist?
That's a great question. It depends on what day you find me, you know, and I get that question, you know, Dr. Doherty, how do you maintain hope? And I say, well, simple, I don't. Like some days I feel hopeless, but that's normal at times to feel hopeless when you're struggling with something. One of my therapy sayings is despair is fatigue in disguise. So often when I'm feeling despairing, I have to check in. Am I getting enough rest, exercise? Because when I'm tired, when I'm worn down, I'm much more likely to feel despair. And that's when I need to turn off the news and go outside, take care of myself, be with my family. Like I tell clients, your life is the news. So the news is not on a screen. The news is right out your door, out my window. You know, go look at the news for a while, control your nervous system, calm down. And then, of course, then naturally, oh, there's some that positive spiral can start. So I guess if I had to choose, I would say I was an optimist because that's a choice that I would make existentially. But in terms of my feelings, I toggle like everyone else between positivity and negativity, depending on the stories that I read in the news and, you know, how I'm doing.
If you're just tuning in, this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. My guest is Dr. Thomas Doherty, a clinical and environmental psychologist, 30 years experience specializing in applying an environmental perspective to mental health and well-being through his practice, A Sustainable Self. And you're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. So, Dr. Doherty, let's talk about your practice, this idea of applying an environmental perspective to mental health and well-being. What does that look like if I am a client and I call up and make an appointment with you and I want to do walking therapy with you? What is the perspective you're going to bring to me?
Yeah. Well, again, like we talked earlier, it could just be a modality where walking therapy, for example, could be a modality where you talk about anything. Someone wants to talk about their life or their job or their family or their relationship. And rather than sitting in an office, we walk and talk. And that opens us up to the outdoors and to nature, and it's exercise and it's physical and it's active. And it's just it for some for many people, especially post-COVID, there's been a lot of changes in therapy, and it's really liberated therapy to be done in different forms. You know, frankly, a lot of people prefer to walk than to sit, and they like to walk and talk. It's quite normal, even in our regular lives, to go to walk and talk with our friends, and we walk around and we gesture with our arms and we look around. That's like very normal. In some ways, sitting in an office and staring at someone is the part that's not very normal. It's so intense. So So some of it's just a modality, but it's also, all if you want to get really simple about this, across history, new issues and problems have come up, and therapists have led the way to open the door to have people talk about them, whether it's concerns about your sexual identity or concerns about depression or ADHD. And then suddenly that becomes a thing that therapists need to know about because the public expects help with it. And it becomes a standard of practice. And what's happened now is that it's become a standard of practice that the public wants help. They know about eco-anxiety. People have heard the term. They say, oh, there's a word for this thing I've been feeling. Who can help me with this? And then they'll look for therapists that have on their list of, things they do, like eco-anxiety, or I'm a climate conscious therapist. And the public says, oh, okay, I can go talk to that person. And so that's kind of what this is. It's just opening the door for people to talk about this as a part of their life. What's unique about ecotherapy, I have this saying, another one of my therapy sayings is validate, elevate, create. So it could be used with any problem, really, but it's really helpful with eco issues where you validate them, first of all, like, hey, this is important. It is, you're normal if you have this concern. So let's talk about this. But then what's radical about ecotherapy is we elevate it. We say, let's make this the most important thing to talk about, not a second or third level thing. Like, oh, therapy, we have to talk about your relationship or your job. That's no. Your eco anxiety and your environmental is the most, for this moment, let's talk about it as the most important thing. And that's really powerful for people because I can tell you most people have never in their life had that opportunity to think about their environmental values with someone as the most important thing for that moment. And it's so freeing and reassuring. So, from finally, I can talk about this sort of stuff. Doesn't mean I'm going to talk about it forever. No, there's other issues, obviously, but for now, and then we get creative about it. Validate, elevate, create. Where does it come from? How do you know about it? What are your concerns? How do we educate ourselves? Validate, elevate, and meditate. Maybe we just need to sit with this. So it's basically creating a space for these kind of global issues to be talked about in some practical way in the therapy session. That's the goal.
I really have attached myself to the idea of the environmental identity piece of this as being something like our sexual identity or our relational identity. And I would imagine that if people spent time and energy into forming their ecological identity, that it would make them feel empowered in some ways, or maybe more fully formed, because there's this sense that everything's happening to us instead of being a part of it. And I imagine if we have an ecological identity that attaches us to nature, it could drive an action, and it could
Exactly.
also drive a sense of belonging and not being outside of, if that makes sense. Because I think one of the challenges that I experience working with clients is they want to take action, but the action just feels too big. And by narrowing it down to having this is your identity, then you know what the action is. It almost naturally comes from that. Am I following that?
No, you're exactly right. That's why I say therapists are great at this because you pulled all this together really quickly, and it's exactly right. For listeners, one of the exercises that I do with people to help them discover their environmental identity is just discover what already exists. So if you draw a timeline of your life from birth to the present, and just start making little hash marks on the timeline about significant experiences in nature, the natural world, where you grew up, mentors or family, outdoor experiences, pets, animals, peak experiences like going and traveling or seeing the northern lights or something special, and also tragedies and losses, deaths, a favorite tree gets to cut down, and global issues, storms, you ha everyone has a timeline already existing. They just haven't thought about it in that way. And then you start to see, oh, my environmental identity has been existing for a long time, and it's been building uniquely for all these building blocks. And then now, today, I can extend my timeline. That's the metaphor then, is like extending your timeline into the future. And then why I love environmental identity is that once you hear it once, you know it for the rest of your life. Like you realize, oh, I have this thing. So for you as an educator, when you tell undergraduates about this, then they know about it for the rest of their life, you know. So it's a really great gift.
Yeah, it is. And then I imagine also when you're doing the work, when someone knows her environmental identity, to be able to talk about the big fear items, it kind of gives it a place, because you talked earlier about how important language is and the mindfulness. And so if I'm with you here, we have our timeline, and then you can see, so what, where are the things we're grieving in our timeline, and where are the things we feel joy in our timeline, and so that you actually feel like you're having some locus of control on how you respond to your environmental feelings, not just in the negative, but also have identified the joys.
It provides a foundation. A lot of the challenge with eco anxiety is it's they don't people don't know how to make sense of it. Like they know they're having the feelings, but they don't know where it came from, and they don't realize there's this long history. The eco anxiety you have now is just one part of your long-term connection with nature. And once you see all that, oh, it makes sense, and that is very grounding. I'm here, I'm in the present, it's grounding. And then, like other things, it does bring that empowerment. Like, hey, wait, this is something that I can actually direct. I can start to steer myself in different directions. And so that's where it gets really exciting in therapy, because then it's sort of like, well, where do you want to go? Well, some people want to learn about nature, and they want to learn about birds, or they want to be more comfortable camping, or they have a sports goal, like they want to learn how to hike or fish or go swimming, and that can be really super powerful. Or they say, I want to be active politically, or I want to, or I want to be with my family, or I want to help my kids to develop their environmental identity, because parents are the main creator of our environmental identity, is our parents when we're younger. And just reminding parents of that is a huge gift to them, because then, oh, okay, I'm working on my environmental identity, and I'm also supporting my child's, and then it all makes sense. And it's a much better way to approach eco anxiety than just, fretting
Right,
about it.
fretting from where we started this hour. I know, I love that you've given us this tangible thing that people can actually apply to their life. And then also, you brought in another piece, which is the nature anxiety that has become so, Richard Louv talked about Last Child in the Woods. I think this book is 20 plus years old. That we've raised now two generations of children that actually fear the outdoors and the environment. And how is that lending to kind of our climate decline if you have two generations of young people who actually are afraid of nature? They spend more time indoors playing video games than ever in the past, less time outside playing or being interacting. I remember, one of the greatest fears, they did a poll of preschoolers and school-aged children, one of their greatest fears was sharks. And it was all went back to Shark Week, the television series, because that's the only experience they were having with nature, was watching the show that made them terrified. So I wonder how that leads into this work. How do we bring those generations back?
So the fancy term for that, it would be ecophobia, or learned ecophobia. So it's a not a rational thing, it's this learned response, and it does come from a superficial kind of symbolic connection with nature outside of a real connection. And part of dealing with eco anxiety and dealing with nature fears is learning to be more realistic about what's literally going to happen. Just like any anxiety is, when we get into anxiety treatment, anxiety is fear wrapped in a cloud, and it's a natural response to a vague threat, and so we have to dispel the cloud. And it's nice to respect nature. Animals, bears, wild, mountain lions, sharks are dangerous. The reality is, the odds of you getting attacked by these animals, you're far more likely to get struck by lightning on Mars than to ever e even co encounter these things. So the things we need to be afraid of are like unhealthy food that we eat, and technology is far more dangerous to our screens, and so it helps, even with climate. One of the things I also do with around climate anxiety with people is literally help them to look at I call it your individual problems with climate change report, your IPCC report. What literally is going to happen in your area climate-wise? Is it storm? Is it fire? Is it drought? Is it flood? How frequent they are they? What can we expect in the next 5 to 10 years? What are you doing about that? So yes, there's things happening all around the world, but let's just think about your place and realistically work on this. And that can be very grounding for people too. They start to take some action, and then suddenly this isn't this global cloud. It's like, oh, I live in Central Coast of California or in Minnesota or Florida. This is my problems with climate change, and I can take action with my home, my family, my neighborhood. And that, you know, so there's a lot of juicy, very empowering little nuggets in the work.
I love that. And as we come to the end of our hour, which went far too quickly, I guess I'm hearing like almost two places. One is the people that already have a strong ecological environment are coming with their frets and their fears for the future. And then we have to deal with the double generations that have been disconnected physically from nature because of technology and being more indoors and just fears by parents of not letting their kids outside. It's almost like there's two ends of a spectrum of addressing eco experiences that we have to look at.
Yeah, and luckily, you know, we are nature and we're part of the planet, so it isn't that hard to reconnect. You know, like I say to students, you know, when you're climbing a tree, your hand feels good on the branch because your hand evolved to climb on that branch. Your hands and the branch evolved together. So we are not that far as from nature as we think. It's right there. Literally a few hours a day in the outdoors away from screens will reset our nervous systems and bring us back to that more natural way of being. So it's possible.
My guest today has been Dr. Thomas Doherty, clinical environmental psychologist from Portland, Oregon, 30 years specializing in the world of eco-psychology. He is the co-host of the international podcast, Climate Change and Happiness: How to Cope with Climate Stress. And you can find that podcast, I would imagine, anywhere that you look for podcasts. If you want to learn more about your ecological identity and climate change, and also look for Dr. Doherty's upcoming book. When is your book going to be released?
My book will be released this summer of 2020, 2025, upcoming summer from Little Brown Publishers. Yeah, Surviving Climate Anxiety. And we talk about anxiety, but we talk about identity and thriving and coping in the book. It's kind of the whole package.
So when you get the book out, you're going to come back hopefully and visit with me, and we can talk about it more in depth. But
Yes.
until then, can people contact you through your practice?
Yeah, people can find me at selfsustain.com or at climatechangeandhappiness.com, either way, and I'm happy to connect with people.
Thank you. I really appreciate your time today, Dr. Doherty. This has been a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. Find me on Facebook or Instagram. Leave me a message there. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org or podcast our show to listen to at your convenience and share with your friends. As always, thank you for being a part of our community and supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Don't give up, although you can see all the world and the rest that we're making. Can't give up the hope God would intercede. Come on back, imagine that we could get it together. Stand on for what we need to be. 'Cause crying won't save or feed a hungry child. Can't lay down and wait for some miracle change.